I think you just want some nice people and who started out fairly smart, and then you make them a bunch smarter. They
Okay.
get the actual line superintelligence. They probably don't just send it straight out to unleash coherent extrapolated volition upon the world. They are probably building a super engineer and maybe using that to upload themselves into computers so that they can keep on working for this for another 1,000 years without the world burning down in the meantime. But, they're running faster inside there. And so from our perspective, it's like only a day or 3 days, and then out comes the super intelligence that is actually supposed to be nice. And then we live happily ever afterwards. I think I would not immediately in the next 30 seconds of the happily ever after, decide to grow tentacles. It has not been a lifelong ambition of mine to grow tentacles.
Oh, we differ in that regard.
I sure can't see myself like immediately going to, back to, age 20 body and, preferably not even that exact body. There's all sorts of obvious improvements. I might not even want to go down a detailed checklist. I think this is the
No,
sort of
yeah,
thing
not
that
on this
any
show.
AI could guess about me by reading what I've written on the internet, to say nothing of reading my mind. And, just go straight there. These things are trivial from my perspective. Abandoning my body entirely, well, why would I want to change that quickly? But in 1,000 years, would I still be a little organic life form running around? Would I still think of myself as having hands with 10 fingers? It seems improbable.
This is Dan Fagelli. You're tuned in to The Trajectory, and this is our sixth and final episode of the AGI Governance series. There is no complete series on AGI safety without Eliezer Yudkowsky himself, one of the few people who's been writing about this for multiple decades. As of late, has very much been railing against the immediate risks of artificial general intelligence. Everyone's heard his opinions on that. This episode is different. We go into what his ideal governance structures would look like and how they might be rolled out, although he admits he's not a policymaker. But I thought his ideas were pretty darn well fleshed out. In addition to that, we talk about what would happen if we got it right. What is the right post-human trajectory in the mind of Yudkowsky, assuming governance gets nailed? Never seen him articulate this. Never seen an article about this. This was a lot of fun to unpack. All those of you who followed Eliezer, you have not seen an episode like this. So enjoy. Without further ado, let's fly right in. This is Eliezer himself here in The Trajectory. So Eliezer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, glad to be able to connect here. My questions are in part informed by Twitter, who refers to you as Yud, which has been a very strange last year or so kind of revelation here. In terms of what folks want to dive into, before we get into governance, the idea of kind of AI alignment being tractable at all seems a little bit less of your opinion and attitude. We have folks like Roman Yampolsky who are very much of the this can't be done from a technical standpoint. Bengio has written on some level that that may in fact be the case. Is that where you stand now, just to clarify, in terms of what people have seen from you in the last year?
To me, it seems very clearly possible in principle. And it also seems very clear that if we go in on anything remotely resembling the current trajectory, we're going to splat all over the wall instead. Like, is there some computer program that does it? Yes. Will we be able to write it and have it not failure under like the first serious and lethal load? No. Generally speaking, in engineering, when you're working with your very poorly understood alchemical mixtures of stuff that you just like mix together until it's finally started doing what you wanted, you know what went into the recipe, but not quite what's going on in there. And, you're trying some unprecedented new feat of scale, or unprecedented in any number of ways, really. Something goes wrong that you haven't thought of.
This is the whole we only get one shot kind of shebang.
Think I'm having to rename that because the opposition here has successfully muddled the waters and been like, what do you mean it's only one shot? We can try it on smaller AIs first. So if you say one shot, they're like, what do you mean we only get one shot? And there's a leap of death here. And the leap of death is between the systems that are not smart enough for screwing up to be fatal and the systems that are that smart. Now, if you've got a lethally smart superintelligence on your hands, it had better already be aligned. So you must have carried out your alignment work at some earlier point. You must have done something before it was a superintelligence, before, like mistakes would be lethal. You must have done your alignment work before then. And yet that has to cross over to when it can actually kill you. So it's not that you get zero experience with anything, but you don't get experience keeping, you don't get plenty of mistakes in the control of systems that are actually powerful enough to kill you. So, and this jump probably corresponds to a number of qualitative changes in practice. Just to give the obvious example, the very fact that it has the option of killing you, the real option that it thinks it could do it and could do it, is something different from your testing conditions, where if it was thinking clearly, it knows that it, can't take you on. Now, you could say, like, well, then we'll surely panic as soon as the little small AIs ever once talk about planning to take us on or try to make a move when it won't work for them. But of course, that's already behind us at this point. We already have little AIs doing that under conditions where nobody got alarmed. So everybody is already used to ignoring those alarms, which genuinely were false alarms at first. But when do we turn around in the future? And, in real life, you're just going to die here. It's not that this is theoretically impossible. It's not that there's some fundamental theoretical barrier that anyone has identified. I think that that's kind of, bullcrap. But it's just like in real engineering life, stuff doesn't work that well on the first serious try under the first serious load. I can't say one shot because it'll be like, oh, but we can try it on smaller AIs first.
Yeah. So the thought here is you may be coming up with a new name for this whole, we only get one shot. You mentioned kind of the leap of death or something like that. Does this have a new name yet, or is it still in the works?
Still in the works. I'm I'm considering leap of death. I don't know if it'll catch on.
It's definitely on brand.
What one shot was a term that would have worked perfectly fine to communicate the key idea, which is that, like a space probe, once you've launched it, once it goes high enough, you can't just run out and fix it if something goes wrong. You can try it on smaller versions on Earth first, but that's not quite the same. But people have successfully muddled the waters, and sometimes you just have to concede that your evil, intellectually dishonest opponents have, gotten one up on you and changed the terminology.
Yeah. You've also brought up that you do not see it as inherently intractable, just in practice, the fact that we could somehow modularly get it all right bit by bit and on a first shake is not possible. There's sort of folks that say, hey, if in, writ large, I mean, Hinton's kind of maybe hinted at this. Bengio linked to some ACM paper that I didn't read the whole thing of, but the basic ideas of like the intractability of eternally bounding something with astronomically more sort of general capability for problem solving than yourself may just not be a thing we can do. For you, it's like, well, maybe it is, or for you, it might be BS that would be a permanent barrier, but the thread we'd have to follow to land in that sort of golden place is more of the impossibility. It's not that you consider it impossible. You think it hypothetically could be.
For a long time, artificial intelligence was blocked on the problem of how you train a neural network more than three layers deep. And, as we know nowadays, it's called deep learning. Fellow named Hinton and several others invented it.
Yeah.
It's totally possible to go several layers deep in a neural network, despite the problem of exploding and vanishing gradients. You just need, ReLUs and the correct initialization and residual links and, a whole bunch of little pack of engineering tricks that, people found in practice by seeing what didn't hold up at scale and trying a lot of tricks until they found the tricks that did hold up at scale. And if we got to try over and over again, we would figure out how, which things don't break down once the thing is super intelligent and can kill you. And the simple tricks that are robust. And we'd get it done in due time if it worked the same way as other scientific problems and didn't kill everyone on Earth the first time it failed under load.
So a million trillion simulations of reality, maybe somebody cracks it, not feasible in practice. Are you of the belief here that this, in that trillion trillion scenario, we would then cut off its ability to continue to improve? Because presumably here, if it fooms in capability, the idea that it will remain eternally aligned in whatever value calibrated way you're talking about feels unlikely. But what do you mean there?
I don't think it is unlikely. I think it is the sort of thing that would be, you know, I think if you intelligence augmented humans and you get them up to, you know, like one or two measured standard deviations past John von Neumann, you know, not in terms of like standard deviations post facto, but in terms of standards, you know, people start to like throw out random quibbles if you invoke the concept of measuring human intelligence at all. But, you know, go 30 RQ points past John von Neumann, give him a few years. I would, you know, be at over, yeah, I would be like, I don't know, like 20, 30% they can get it in a few years and like 60% they could get it in a few decades. And the main thing you want is just that they're past the point where people expect stuff to work that doesn't. That's a big theme in the early decades of AI. People would come up with all sorts of clever ideas that they expected to see to have work, and then they wouldn't work because it's human, right? You know, you get hopeful, you get optimistic. So if we could push human intelligence augmentation past the point where people stop being such idiots in that deep human way, where they stop expecting stuff to work that ain't going to work, I think that's probably something like the qualitative threshold of how smart you have to be to one-shot arbitrarily powerful superintelligence without a bunch of trial and error that kills you. I could be wrong, but it's what I would try.
Got it. You're saying there's a version of that intelligence that even if it goes up, again, I know people get offended by any measure of intelligence, but you go ahead and use your von Neumann, you know, as a unit of measurement or whatever. IQ is a unit of measurement, whatever we want, it doesn't really matter. If it vastly expands in its overall potential, ability to do, enact, think, create, whatever, for you, there is a version of that hypothetically where the treat humans nice in whatever way you would want would still be there and be manifested in the same way, despite the fact that maybe a month later, the thing would have 10 times more or 100 times more general capability or resources at its disposal, et cetera, like that.
In principle, there is no obstacle to that. I think I see how you do it, like in principle, but you know, like practice is a whole
different thing,
another story. And you know, not with anything like neural nets.
Yeah.
Like if you're trying to like train a neural net to play nicely and then it gets much more powerful because of some scaling principle or other, like length of inference or whatever, that ain't, you know, maybe there is some level of superintelligence where you can pull that off, but that's not what I'm imagining our John von Neumann's doing. They're going past the paradigm of you train a black box from the outside until it seems to play nice and then give it a whole bunch of new options.
Yeah.
They're not going to be making that fly. They're going to be running on a different paradigm, something that is like a much more powerful and sophisticated version of how when you build a chess-playing AI and you make it play much better chess, much able to search further into the search tree, that doesn't change which games it defines as winning. Now, the reason why this is a trivial problem does have a lot to do with how this isn't a general intelligence. It doesn't reflect on itself. It doesn't need to be stable under reflection. You don't need to consider what happens as it self-modifies. But as much as these things will utterly torpedo the project of training a black box neural network you don't understand from the outside to do these things, it's not a theoretical barrier. It seems like the sort of thing that's very clearly physically possible.
I think that's reasonable. With that said, you know, it's physically possible, but you're you know, I mean, death with dignity here has been a recent theme. No optimist that it's going to go down that way. We do see some folks who are awfully trepidatious about where AGI is sort of potentially taking us in the near term, who are also pretty ravenously focused on how the heck we prevent the kinds of brute arms races that might just blast us into that as soon as humanly possible. So this could involve U.S.-China relations. This could involve starting with some kind of national governance, some way to bound the human incentives of the race to either give us more time or maybe in some optimistic world, land in a spot that's maybe even better than life today. People who know you very well for your arguments around risk and sort of why AGI would kill us and maybe even how. Is there a reason you haven't talked that much about, you know, you talk about coordination being hard as hell, and folks like Cristiano and others who've commented on your thoughts there agree. I mean, I think I would too. Why haven't you talked a lot about coordination governance out of curiosity?
I mean, I have spoken a bit about it on Twitter or even in like Time magazine. You want an international agreement to, you know, basically, well, ideally you'd shut the entire thing down, but failing that, limit it to stuff that you are really quite darn sure won't kill you, which in practice probably means just like the most intelligent system somebody made before then, because you push it any further than that and, you know, maybe it gets smart enough to self-improve. I'm not predicting that will happen with GPT-5. I'm saying that I don't know if it happens if GPT-5, GPT-6, whatever.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of, I agree that there's a lot of details here. I'm not quite expert in those details. I think that that there are probably a number of people in government who, if they actually got what I think of as the basic, like empirical setup that I'm trying to describe.
Yep.
That if anyone anywhere on Earth builds the following thing, everybody on Earth dies, then they are in some ways better placed than I am to figure out exactly how you manage to pass international treaties about that, which is not to say that I'm not thinking about it. But there is a sense in which I've been trying to say, like, to Earth's leadership, such leadership mm-hmm. as Earth has.
Yes, yes.
Like, if anyone anywhere builds this thing, everyone will die. The amount of computing power it takes will drop over time as if you let people go on inventing and sharing new algorithms among themselves. And you need to tell them to stop doing that. I can talk, like, it seems like when I look at this, I imagine a symmetrical treaty between international parties, which is very careful to not suggest that anyone signatory to it is being humiliated by the greater powers that sign it, or that they're not one of the greater powers themselves, as the case may be, and that where like everyone has symmetrical rights, all the countries are allowed to do those things that you are still allowed to do with the computing power. There's no country that is allowed to use it for spying purposes or military purposes and the other countries can't, haha. That's not the, you know, when I visualize an international treaty, I don't visualize it working like that. But now we're off into the field of things where I am no longer an expert.
Understood. So there's a reasonable supposition. What you're saying is, you know, sort of my role in this is to paint the picture of risk and the coherent arguments as to why this would be risky and not, you know, probably good, but probably ill. Someone else ought to figure it out. But at least from your vantage point, some degree of grand international treaty would be required. I mean, people jest about the bombing data centers kind of thing. Let's just pretend there was a first step for you. It sounds like the world, you know, the countries that are part of the UN or whoever facilitates this, it doesn't, maybe you've got an idea that you think it's less likely to be within the UN than out. And again, this isn't, I'm not saying we're going to instantiate your governance ideas. I'm just saying, would love your instincts. I mean, you think about these things, people are interested in your thoughts. There were a first step and it was at all in any way enforceable. The details are beyond me and some of them are beyond you. But what do you suspect that would look like? One country leads the way and so US says, hey, China, I mean, it feels like maybe you would have to start with the great powers. What would be the dominoes that could fall in that off chance that we coordinate that you think might have a shot?
Okay, like prefacing again, you know, if a senator asks, I can speak with some authority on like, these are the things that no one can say if they will kill you or not, if people are allowed to do them. These are the things that will eventually kill you if you do more of them. If somebody says that this particular thing is safe, they're wrong, show me the argument, I'll shoot it down. We are now off into the territory where I am, you know, much more spitballing. You know, I want that clearly yeah. understood. I'm no totally. Longer speaking with the same kind of, this is the thing I'm an expert on.
Absolutely.
With that said, you did ask about the first enforceable step. I do want to say that before that, there would come a step of world leaders declaring in something like unison or like key world leaders, you know, like US, UK, China, Netherlands, possibly Russia, if nuclear deterrence is part of the equation, just sort of all saying, like, we'd like humanity to not go extinct, and we're willing to do international treaties about that. That even comes before the treaty itself is negotiated. You get a step one, a thing that leaders can do unilaterally, saying, like, you know, we aren't going to stop everything unilaterally. We're not going to disadvantage ourselves relative to other countries, but we stand ready to do arms control agreements about AI. Then we're on to sort of step one. So when I imagine this, the current rules, which are that NVIDIA is not allowed to sell certain chips to China, get changed into NVIDIA is not allowed to sell a broader range of chips than that, because NVIDIA is like evading the ass out of the restrictions, of course. They don't care. I don't think they have to care. But NVIDIA and any companies that imitate them can only sell chips into these limited number of internationally monitored data centers. There's this, I'm not sure what's the optimal number of data centers is. It seems to me that especially for training the AIs, you don't need low latency communications to anywhere. So I do tend to envision that you've got like some big data centers, but maybe you got to distribute it more broadly than that because of the, you know, practicalities of supplying electrical energy. Anyways, you've got some number of training data centers. Each one of those has an observer from the US, the UK, China, probably the Netherlands is not posting observers to all these places. I mentioned them because they've got the sole manufacturer of equipment that is used to make the chip making factories.
Mm-hmm. The lithography technology there.
Yeah. And then there are rules about which kind of training you're supposed to be running over here. Insofar as the companies own some of the chips that are being collected up and put into these centers, and, you know, maybe the chips have owners, but even if you own a chip on paper, anytime you send instructions to run a job, everything you do gets logged. If you evade these restrictions in any way, it is a big deal. Not just this employee, but maybe the whole company gets seriously fined or just like straight up blacklisted because you don't want to let them do lots of little futzy things trying to evade the thing. Yeah. This is maybe an obstacle to AI research, and you cannot research AI as fast. I think that humanity should be willing to pay that price to decrease the probability of extinction. I'm sure that many individual AI researchers will be very upset that they can't just like send whatever orders they want to whatever GPU they want. And, you know, maybe they even have to file some paperwork first. This will, in fact, slow down AI progress. Okay.
Yeah, no, you're laying out your case. I'm certainly not pushing against it. I mean, my aim is just to shake out your idea. But your thought is that, yes, there would be all those various sort of observers. There would be a consistent logging process. This is good. And again, to be clear, you said you're spitballing. You totally are. Kind of everybody is in this domain. I think the productive facet of conversation, as far as I can tell, is layering different spitballings that contain different pieces and being able to put that stuff together. That's what sharing these ideas are. And if there's any hope of getting this done, I don't think it's going to come out of one senator either. So I see the nuclear analogy, but I dig where you're heading. Anything else that kind of follows from there? We get those treaties, we have those consistent logs. And from what you're saying, the companies that produce the chips, you know, they've got certain sort of restrictions, boundaries. Each nation has certain, we would call them kind of training run data centers, that are sort of where they have to do sort of their bigger advanced training in some way.
But they're not super like each country's. Like the US version of this is not significantly different from China's version of this.
Yeah.
Like if China owned a bunch of chips inside a US center, they would be allowed to do things from the limited list of things that all of the international signatories are allowed to do. Same as the United States. That's how I visualize it.
Yep.
When I visualize this, I'm like, you know, the existence of humanity is at stake. Countries like China are not going to want to be humiliated. They are not going to want to sign onto treaties that put them in at a permanent disadvantage. This is not the time to like grub and look for like advantage and like a chance to like humiliate your opponent. This is something where we're supposed to like put all of that crap temporarily on hold, same as with the nuclear arms treaties, same as with preventing global thermonuclear war, which everyone has an interest in. Everybody puts all that on hold, like sets up this as, you know, a symmetrical international arrangement. Maybe somebody genuinely did have an advantage they could have pressed, but instead of fighting that out and maybe having the whole thing come apart, you know, we just go with the obvious, you know, the sort of obvious baseline or symmetrical arrangement. And then the company, and then the countries go back to competing.
Yeah. Well, once this is in place, to your point there. So, data centers, I mean, presumably there would be some overarching body. Maybe this would spin out of the UN. Some people are very bearish that, like, oh, it couldn't be the United Nations. It's too stodgy, or they're not respected enough anymore. Others say it seems like the most likely place for it to start for me. And of course, we have the Secretary General talking about AGI risk, even if almost nobody in the Secretary General's group for AI cares about AGI risk. There might be three or four of them in there, Jan Tallinn among them. Would you see this as what sort of central body, again, spitballing, would seem likely for this kind of a non-humiliating symmetrical agreement that you're articulating?
Speaking as somebody with a distinct lack of real professional experience in the U.S. State Department or the State Department of any country, really, my guess, my first impulse would not be the UN, because I think that there's like a certain amount, I don't know, my impulse is for the arrangements to reflect realities of power and the countries that present the most real threats of otherwise being able to develop AI on their own, like China, the US, the UK, where the UK is in this conversation primarily because Google DeepMind is hosted there. And Google DeepMind, as much as people like to make fun of them, and I think in fact can do a number of things with AI that the other companies have not demonstrated the ability to do, like AlphaFold is a premier example. So from my perspective, it's about like the realities of who is bringing bargaining chips to this table before the symmetrical relationship got put there. I think if you have like a committee with membership randomly drawn from 10 random countries selected out of the UN, then this committee is trying to give orders to great powers, and the actual members on this committee do not have a corresponding amount of power, and that strikes me as an unstable relationship. This concludes my speaking out of a great void of, you know, having ever been the ambassador from any one country to another.
Absolutely. And just to be clear, I mean, I've hardly had anyone on here who has stayed exclusively in their own domain. We had the former head of the Defense Innovation Unit speak on these same topics. Not as close to the AI risk side of things as you are, but kind of talked about the parts that he is familiar with. But it's interesting to get your perspective on that. The presumption here is once we got to that stasis of sorts, assuming we could get there, some people might say, hey, these data centers that are kind of innocuous at this size today, presuming even like light degrees of algorithmic improvement or other sorts of things, even that are innocuous and kind of very much are not just skirting the edges, but are not breaking the rules of the current paradigm, could make it so that a data center much, much smaller, which maybe we don't have in our register, could be conjuring something that might be sort of breaking these rules, in which case maybe we'd have to get down to smaller levels of compute. Of course, there are folks that say, hey, this has to be tyrannical and we have to get into everybody's phone. And that's why any idea like this is a terrible idea. You certainly are not making an argument for tyranny. You're making an argument for survival. So I'm not questioning.
Tyrants have often made arguments in the name of survival.
Oh, no doubt about it. I'm not saying your path is necessarily right. I'm saying it's an idea. And I'm saying, you have at least reasons.
Have also made arguments in the name of survival. Yes,
that's absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. Both camps. So I don't call anyone an angel or a devil. Like, oh, I interview this camp and I make fun of them. I interview this camp and all of their, you know, everything they say is fantastic and coming from the right place. But, you know, you've made rational arguments for safety. But some folks have said, hey, this has got to shrink all the way down to a cell phone. How the heck are we going to keep up with that? What are your thoughts there? Presumably there might be a way to maintain that stasis even as the tech gets more capable, or maybe to prevent certain kinds of hardware developments altogether that would make a single laptop or somebody's closet full of some kind of new compute into an actual danger. How would you see that tackled? Assuming the first stasis could ever be achieved, where would that go from there for you?
Are you saying stasis or stages?
Oh, stasis. So, like, let's assume, like you had said, the competition, we're all going to outrun each other and do all that. We can sort of hold off for long enough for different people to sort of sign their symmetrical agreement and check in on each other's stuff and register those big data centers. And for a little bit, some of that stuff chills. Now, of course, the world doesn't stop, but some of that stuff chills. That's the initial point of pseudo-stasis, let's say. It's very different than the race dynamic we're experiencing today.
I'd be much more calling it, pause seems a bit disingenuous if there's no explicit plan to unpause. Stasis sounds physically unrealistic. As you say, the world keeps changing. I can't say I'm a fan of that particular term. It sounds like the sort of term somebody would apply to this if they were, an opponent strawmanning the position. Of course, you don't get stasis.
Yeah, that ain't my position. So what do you want to rename it? Rename it whatever you want.
Ban might be appropriate.
Okay, ban. All right, so it's just more firm, straight up ban. And at that point, would the ban make it so that a smaller data center could not be dangerous? Would that be the very nature of the ban?
Leaving aside the initial terminological quibble, what humanity and humanity's leaders are willing to do here will depend on how severe they think the threat is. If humanity woke up tomorrow believing what I believe, people knew that the police officers and the military officers believed it too, this is more of a, like, people just walk out of their houses and walk over to the GPU factories and the data centers and just, like, physically shut it all down pending other arrangements and might just straight up making more of the GPUs if they believed what I believe. If they believe part of what I believe, mm-hmm. Or they believe that it's a difficult call if that Yudkowsky person is correct, which does not mean that he is wrong. That might imply actions less extreme than that in terms of preventing the utter extinction of humanity and its posterity. So when I visualize this playing out, I imagine that people might try to control the computation on a training runs and then wait for progress in algorithms to visibly start to be a problem and then impose progress, try to do something about the continued development of better, better is a questionable word here.
Yes.
More efficient algorithms for destroying the world. And I would take the initial construction of the data centers, because if you're taking a step like that, you are, more likely to then be willing to take some actually less expensive, play is poor in the press or whatever, steps to restrain the relentless development of more efficient algorithms for destroying the world. Or maybe you just control the whole thing up front. But I don't want this to be a, like, good as the enemy of the best situation. I don't want to be disingenuous about it, but if the initial coalition is just about, like, coraling the hardware, fine. I would tell them, like, if you're doing this, coral all the AI training hardware. You cannot own, like, one copy of this in your backyard. There's no reason to let people own one copy of this in the backyard. It can be at the, licensed, monitored, internationally monitored data centers, and they can do on this thing that they own inside the data center, whatever is legal to you to do there with everything logged. So even if algorithms do start to lower the size of the data center required, I do think that in step one, you have gotten everything you can into the data centers and it is illegal for it to be outside of international monitoring. So you do not die immediately after the size of the data center required to destroy the world drops by a factor of 10.
Yeah.
That said, if it sure is looking like the size of data center required to destroy the world is dropping by a factor of 10, then yeah, you are probably going to want to make that illegal the same way that I would say that it should have been illegal to publish the DNA for smallpox, or even to have certain sorts of, in public research conversations of the sort that led to the construction of various engineered superviruses, with what I suspect to be one notable example, but that's a rabbit hole we shouldn't go down.
Not for this show. So I'm starting to get a cogent picture here. And for the record, I think the likelihood of human attenuation pretty immediately after AGI is hurled into the world is outlandishly high, and have been public about that for a great many years. So I can see the rationale through and through here. I'm going to just sort of play out what this could look like, assuming this could succeed. And you're no optimist, but painting the picture is maybe a 0.00001% of the way there. So we get to this place where the ban is fully in place. Like, to your point, maybe if people fully saw what you saw, believed what you believe, they'd be out there just breaking down TSMC's doors already.
Well, I mean, assuming that they correctly knew that the police would not interfere because the police on board the same ship.
I do not
advocate trying this if the police are not on board, because
that's
then
a good distinction.
Just drag you off to jail and nothing has been accomplished.
It's a good distinction. So, but yes, to your point, you made that sort of, assuming it goes more gradually, we have this data center consideration. It gets to the point where having any of this stuff at home, just, you know, not on the table. Do you see that as a world where deep in these data centers, the approved stuff is, you know, cure cancer, whatever the case may be. I have no idea what would be going on in there. And that most of our, some of the economic kind of health related things really kind of could be solved in there? Or do you see it as more like it's almost packing the genie away, because if we're curing cancer, then we're conjuring other things, and that's probably not good? Like, in other words, some people would see the future you're talking about as like, hey, maybe it's kind of going to be like Japan, like kind of stuck in the 90s, but maybe it would be kind of cool because we're not all dead. Others would say, oh, maybe AI, if it was corralled, could sort of, in an oracle-like sense, conjure forth certain things based on very stringent prompts and potentially improve the human condition. What would you see that look like?
If you have something around that's smarter than humanity, you are, like, very significant chunk of probability dead. If you have something around that is much smarter than humanity, you are definitely dead. It is not a question of the uses to which AI is put, it is the question of the uses to which AI puts itself.
So I'm following, like, you here. I'm not saying we have God in a box. I'm saying that we have DeepFold that can do more stuff. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. So AlphaFold is a kind of AI where you can probably push it better at being good at the things that it does narrowly without dying, compared to how far you could push things that are trying to be as general as they are trying to make ChatGPT or Claude general. Like, if you keep on pushing those, you die earlier, probably.
I like this thing.
So if you want to tickle the dragon's tail, if you want to, you know, like, dance a little bit closer to the edge of extinction in hopes of getting some goodies that gets, you know, hopefully shared around symmetrically under this international treaty, then you can, like, have AlphaFold 4, AlphaFold 5, and it's just not supposed to be smart enough to carry on a conversation with the human. It's supposed to be good enough to figure out stuff having to do with biology. It is not reading biology papers. Maybe some other AI that can read English is translating the biology papers into the special purpose language you feed to AlphaFold, which is not trained on the internet, which is like not being trained on anything to do with humanity, with our general intelligence. Now, there is probably some level to which you can, where if you just, like, take a black box and you just, like, keep grinding it to be better and better and better and better at just doing biology, even in a special language, this probably still kills you eventually. Remember, the case of human evolution, like, we're out there trying to tip flint spears and, you know, I don't think we even, like, figured out bows and arrows by the time most of the evolving was done to our present form.
Yep.
You know, we are taming fire. We are trying to outwit each other in these little tribal political battles. And that was probably a whole lot of it. But that's part of what makes it an open-ended competitive process. You know, we learn to model other people, and then we repurpose that brain circuitry for modeling ourselves. And it turns out that modeling yourself really makes you a lot more generally intelligent, and we got way better at that chipping Flynn Spears thing. And then we went to the moon, but we weren't being selected to go to the moon. going to the moon is just how this system generalizes when it, you know, gets far enough. So, you know, if you keep on grinding and grinding something just at biology problems in a special purpose language and never train it on the internet, it may nonetheless at some point, you know, you are optimizing this black box from the outside, you're going down gradients of getting slightly better. Maybe at some point it starts modeling itself a bit, organizing its own thoughts internally. And this makes it much better at biology, the same way that it made humans much better at human problems. So the circuitry gets reinforced by, you know, by the gradient descent, not saying it was reinforcement learning or whatever. But the circuitry that is correctly solving this problem gets reinforced. If you push it far enough, it'll eventually kill you. But you can probably push it a lot further than the things that are being trained on the internet, on all of human discourse, and being told to solve this enormous wide variety of problems and talk to humans directly and model humans directly. I can't calculate exactly how far you can push it.
Yeah.
But you can maybe push that system far enough to cure cancer, especially if you are doing this in relatively smart ways that none of these other disaster monkeys have ever suggested, like not training AlphaFold on the internet and instead having some other system, you know, like read the papers and translate into special purpose biology language so that the system that you are pushing to get extremely good at biology is not being trained on, you know, like with full knowledge of what humanity is and that it is the computer and running in a data center and all the other things you learn if you train it on the entire internet.
Yeah. So, well, this is great because again, I think there are folks and I getting your, where you see this, the way I'm thinking about it is like tickling the dragon's tail. Maybe it might get you right away. Tickling the dragon's tongue. You're probably on fire right off the jump. And so what you're saying is, you know, you go into these straight general systems. You're just totally asking for it. But even if you advance and you cure all the diseases, there's probably a threshold where its potential is grand enough to be able to sort of run the show if it wanted to. And if it's plugged into all that other information. So with that said, in the Eliezer world, we're painting kind of a little bit of a coherent picture here of this stuff being locked up. It is not being used to more and more powerfully conjure these outlandishly amazing things, because at some point the black ball is drawn, to pull on our Bostrom here, and it's toast. It's lights out. So when those data centers are locked in, what even happens in there? Do we just burn them and melt them down? Do we use them for innocuous things that like are approved in some way?
We haven't even talked about like control of inference yet. When I imagine control of inference, I imagine that, like actually running the AIs as opposed to training them. Those are things that more need to be connected to the internet. Maybe for the training centers, we want to, you know, physically air gap them from the internet and run a bunch of fiber optic cables to these limited number of data centers so that we're not training our AIs already systems already connected to the internet. What could you possibly be thinking? This is the sort of thing that people used to tell me no one would ever be stupid enough to do. And
I remember the posts. Like, well, they're not going to jack it into the whole internet. You know what I mean? And now that's the origin of the, it's got to be frustrating to be you sometimes.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
If people insist, if people are not sufficiently alarmed to just shut the entire thing down, because why flirt with human extinction? If there are some powerful parties to the negotiations that are like, no, we think that like holding on to the lesser benefits of AI, not smart enough, that is super definitely not smart enough to kill us, allegedly, according to somebody, is worth it, which I would sort of guess to be the case, but I don't want to back down prematurely. Anyway, translation. Probably GPT-4 level, you know, even, or, you know, like even like 2023 level, never mind 2024, you can probably get a system of that level to be like pretty good at real-time translation among all the remaining languages in the world. That's kind of valuable to a global economy. That, you know, if somebody was like being sane about it, if they had an understanding of which things are less and more dangerous, if they were really thinking about like what is like just the immediate greatest economic benefit to humanity, they wouldn't be talking the like far-flung, incredibly dangerous stuff. They'd be thinking, can we just like bring down the language barriers completely? You just go anywhere in the world, you've got a little earpiece. People talk to you and you like hear it said into your earpiece. Maybe you see subtitles projected across your glasses, this sort of thing. I'm surprised we don't have the technology already.
Absolutely.
But it strikes me as a sort of thing that could just be like pretty valuable to humanity in terms of, you know, how that affects the global economy. Teaching children. You don't have to be smarter than the smartest humans and push the frontiers of science to have the tutor that will, with infinite patience, answer all of your child's questions. Now, there are ways to screw this up. You know, like if you just plunge straight ahead into it, not giving a shit the way that you know, people are kind of currently doing, I can imagine ways for talking to a lesser artificial intelligence to screw up your kid. but if you are alert for that, if you are monitoring for that, the infinite supply of infinitely patient tutors for every, you know, child on earth, you know, that doesn't seem like it's pushing the, you know, it's tickling the dragon's tail too much. That is not pushing things too far. And we're talking a world historical civilizational benefit if they can actually pull it off.
Yeah.
Why not name that instead of the far-flung pushing the frontiers of research stuff?
And it sort of dawns on me here, and somebody mentioned this in Twitter as well, you know, your perspective on robotics. Clearly, bipeds a decade ago were still kind of a gag. Bipeds 7 years ago, 5 years ago, still kind of a gag, although less so. You know, I think Boston Dynamics is doing backflips or something. But less so now. My presumption is robotic dexterity for even simple things, never mind complex tasks like plumbing, would almost could that exist in a bounded AI, or is it inherently, if it's interacting with the world, it's touching real things, it's drinking in too much data, it's using too much intelligence, we're already way into tickling the dragon's tongue at that point? In other words, are embodied AIs in anything more than kind of like welding a single car part, whatever's going on today in your average factory, should that be off the table in this world that you're articulating, assuming we want to be able to stay alive for as long as possible? What's your take on robotics?
I think the whole embodiment thing is like this sheer false alarm that a bunch of people got invested in back when they didn't know why their AIs were working. And they said, well, like maybe we'll put it into a robotic body and then it will stop. And then it will like start working. And some people are still sticking to that today, even though we now have a, you know, even though that wasn't what broke the logjam in AI at all.
No, it wasn't.
My guess is that in terms of what will kill you, that the being able to solve the level of cognitive problems involved in moving and steering around a body is, you know, probably not in that league. I may be rolling a 1d20 on this, but my guess is, you know, like a 20-sided die on this.
Yeah.
But my guess is that the dice have to come up one for this particular thing to be the thing that somehow destroys humanity.
So it could be possible that the things that happen in the data center, because even you and I talking right now, me tweeting what I learned about this episode, data centers are involved, whatever else. What you're saying is it could be seen as innocuous, as a robot that could go on your roof and repair it. That it would hypothetically be possible to bound such a machine, assuming everything, you know, was going in or out of it was.
Especially if it's just good at repairing roofs and can't hold it. And it's not the same AI who holds a conversation with you. Maybe if you try to talk to it, that gets routed off to some other AI that isn't actually the one doing all the complex hand-eye coordination and is just good at talking. Because talking is, you know, like being able to converse with a human is like one of the dangerous things, not so much because the conversation itself starts out very dangerous, but because you got to be general to talk.
But
the specialized humanoid robot who is just repairing your roof, that does not strike me as pushing things far enough to be dangerous. You know, chimpanzees have some decent hand-eye coordination, and it actually does and we actually have some degree of knowledge. This thing can come you know, that this thing does not go along with being smart enough to take on humanity and win. Because, you know, chimpanzees, you know, have some decent hand-eye coordination. And they are not our opponents.
No, certainly not a fair fight there. So we're getting into our last question, which we're sort of leaning into now. So
I don't quite want to go on without saying that, although.
Oh, please, go ahead.
Usually in favor of like small amounts of automation on a historical scale, where, you know, like 3% of the people have to find different jobs that year. And there was hopefully, you know, some kind of social net ideally paid for by taxes on these, on the AI companies, you know, which are easier once you centralize them all. You know, you can actually like tax them once there's an international regime in place and not just have them threaten to flee to Thailand or whatever. But if you go from 3% of the population has to find new jobs because of AI this year to 30% of the population has to find new jobs because of AI that year, you are potentially starting to like, you know, like going from like the sort of automation that in the long run is beneficial and why everyone is not a farmer to burning cities. So, so humanoid robots are not flirting with the AI that does, are not so much flirting with the AI that's smart enough that, that will kill us, but they might be flirting with unmanageably fast levels of disemployment, you know, faster than we can reemploy people.
Yeah. So your supposition is this world, this ban, which again, it, maybe in your highest form would simply be the cops are in with it too. Let's just dissemble NVIDIA and TSMC or whoever. But assuming we're in this other ban scenario we've articulated, whatever's happening in those data centers is not enough to just spin forth wealth for humanity. We are still doing work here. And if some kind of technology comes out that offsets 30% of that, there's still way too many social dangers than to be able to count on something like a UBI. Because, of course, this is some people's idea. I think there's versions of this that are worth exploring. There's versions that are just Santa Claus and they're goofy. But there's versions that are worth exploring of, hey, if we can ratchet this at a certain pace and there's enough wealth generated, whether it be food, the ease of food production, whether it be you know, the ability to create shelter more efficiently, whatever, there might be ways where not as many people have to work, et cetera. Do you see that as pretty damn unreasonable? Assuming we're not tickling the dragon here, is it pretty unreasonable that we land in UBI, we're all kind of doing artwork on the weekend kind of stuff? Or what's your take there?
Man, you know, if you know, not to go all Georgist on everybody, but if you have a $1,000 a year UBI in San Francisco, all the rents immediately go up by, you know, like $1,500 a month, or how many people on average are living in the households. It only takes one resource that people still have to bid on, that where there is an obstacle to supplying it, like housing in San Francisco, not housing in Austin, Texas, but housing in San Francisco.
Yep.
All the UBI just immediately goes there. So this is not quite trivial on an economic level. You are going to have to try experiments. One of the few things I will give Sam Altman credit for is that he actually is funding experiments. That's right and proper, in universal basic income specifically. All of this seems likely to go a bit better if it happens over 30 years than if you are hit with all of it simultaneously.
Yeah, in the same week.
This is very much a two-sided coin. If I were not worried about human extinction, I might take my chances on hitting everyone with all the positive changes simultaneously and plan to, and you know, hope to move to whatever country managed to navigate it most successfully.
Right. Yes.
Because of the terrifying fear that if you put this under centralized control, you know, those positive changes are going to be, you know, like trickled out much too slow. Lots of the good stuff is going to get shut down for some crazy ass reason. I think that very likely would happen if you had an international regime in place. The alternative to the international regime is human extinction. It would not, under ordinary circumstances, be in favor of like, oh no, these technological improvements are too scary. Let us throttle the invention of washing machines and agriculture and plumbing and antibiotics, just because our society will have trouble if all of these things are dropped on it simultaneously and 50% of the population is disemployed that year. You know, I might take that scenario over the scenario of there being an international coalition that is allowed to decide that nobody ever gets washing machines. If that, those were the only stakes on the table. The stakes on the table are actually human extinction. The first thing is to do whatever it takes that we just don't all just immediately die. And that might mean that there is somebody voting on whether or not we get washing machines. I hope they vote yes. As long as the washing machines are not like needlessly talking to people and pursuing the frontier and pushing the frontiers of scientific research and in ways, you know, without a specialized AI reading the science papers and translating them out of English, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know,
hooking up the AGI washing machines to the internet. Don't do it, folks. So, all right. I get where you're coming from here. And I think that's it's a bit too much of a straw man for me to say, oh, so you hate washing machines? I don't think this audience is of that ilk. I think we're trying to discern ideas here. And I think there seems to be a categorical difference, in what we're talking about. That said, now that you've touched on sort of the unemployment side, important point. Glad you mentioned it. This is all sort of taking us somewhere. You recently had a debate with Wolfram, who we've had on, a handful of years ago. Which I feel like he was really just trying to kind of understand where you were coming from. I didn't get that much out of some of that. But regardless, you were articulating some of what you were hoping for and wanting to preserve in the world. And you had talked about humanity and you had talked about fun and you had talked about maybe friendship and love and things like that, that you were like, hey, we want to maintain this. There's hardly anybody that I think doesn't want to maintain those things. I think they have different views on risk, et cetera. Maybe there are some misanthropes out there, I'm sure, but they're not the norm. With that said, when you say, here are the things I want to preserve, is it more or less as simple as, hey, I'm Eliezer. Me and all the people I love have opposable thumbs and we have, you know, different kinds of chromosomes that operate in a certain way. And the form that we are in, hopefully happy and healthy, is the form I want to eternally preserve. End of story. That's what a happy future is.
That would be ridiculous. Look at the gray in my beer.
Yeah. Well, I got way too much myself. For you, how would you dial that in? In other words, the things you most want to preserve. You touched on some of it, but it obviously wasn't the focus of the dialogue. I've never really seen it unpacked, but I'd love to get your perspective. What are those worthy things that, for you, are the things we're fighting to preserve here?
So first of all, I will say that if you want it unpacked, there is a thing I wrote a while ago, which stands up better than many other things that I wrote a while ago, called the Fun Theory Sequence. Which is me trying to unpack the things that I know fit into fun.
I'll make sure that that's in the show notes for those of you folks tuned in here. Fun is a category.
And if you want the shorter version, there's a summary of it called 31 Laws of Fun.
31 Laws of Fun. Oh, man. We've got the Peterson-flavored name to go along with it. Bostrom's new book, I mean, we had him on not that long after it came out there. Had some sort of whole set of chapters kind of correlating to fun. Would you actually kind of put fun as kind of a meta umbrella of that which you wish to preserve? Or is it just a part of the state space of value that you would want to ensure persists in the universe? Or do you really see it as a meta category?
So if these things are allowed to be complicated and come with lots of caveats and not be reduced to a simple formula,
then
I might say something like consciousness, fun, and kindness or caring are three of the things that I want to preserve into the future. But somebody is like, well, what about growth and challenge and novelty and like learning new things? And I would be like, oh, well, that's under fun, actually, because, you know, when I wrote up my theory of fun, that was actually in there somewhere. So it's like a very, you know, like it's a definition of fun where somebody's like, what about growth?
Tuck it under fun. Semantically, I've already solved this. It's all under fun. So you mentioned kindness, you mentioned consciousness, you mentioned fun, presumably. I guess things could be kind without being conscious. Maybe. I don't know. Depends on how we define kindness. Fun, one would presume qualia would have to be involved in some way, shape, or form. So certainly consciousness. There are, you know, when we talk to other folks, it was an AGI Futures series. It was a Worthy Successor series about, you know, 10,000 years, 100,000 years, doesn't really matter. You look down, you're a transparent eyeball looking down at the whole universe, and there's a bunch of things going on. What's the scenario where you kind of feel pretty damn good about what's going on? There were folks who had said, if general intelligence could be super sentient, possibly experience wide gradients of bliss, possibly would maybe treat us really well, do other things. You know, I'm not saying it would treat us well, by the way. I'm not here to convince you. I'm telling you what other people said just to get your thoughts, and I'm not going to change your mind. I just want to understand how you think. Then that kind of, that we went up from sea snails to us, there's probably something beyond humor that we don't have words for, something beyond fun we don't have words for. There might be realms of consciousness that are near infinitely rich and splendid that we don't have words for. I'm not telling you you should want those things, Eliezer, but clearly you don't. I'd love your thoughts.
I'd like to be a post-human someday. I think that if I tried to sacrifice all of humanity in a mad quest for personal godhood, it wouldn't even work.
No, that's reasonable, but that's a totally, I understand that point off the jump, but it actually sounds like you are open to it in theory. Like you said, you're not going to risk all of humanity.
Okay, so like, let's back up a bit.
Sure.
Let's talk about the world where they, you know, put all the training hardware into a limited number of data centers. Ideally, I would say with their own, you know, fiber optic cables rather than being connected to the internet per se. There's inference centers that are connected to the internet. The model weights never egress from the, you know, greater number of supervised inference centers. And we manage not to die. Then what? Well, I wouldn't necessarily be trying to sell this as part of the political package, but I think the next step is figuring out adult gene therapy that targets the human brain and trying out some of the genetic polymorphisms that are statistically associated with intelligence in population surveys. And you try artificially introducing some of those, maybe with advanced analysis by AlphaFold 4, to try to guess which things could plausibly help in adults rather than just children. And you see what works for human intelligence augmentation. The volunteers for this are suicide volunteers. Some of them end up schizophrenic or like in a lot of trouble. They knew that risk going in. And the key thing is you can tell if you are making progress on augmenting adult human intelligence. You can tell if the people are getting smarter or not. And this is the fundamental difference that makes this problem tractable through trial and error, where the problem of we will fiddle around with this AI that is not yet dangerous enough to kill us, and then when it can actually kill us, we hope it doesn't kill us. That's the leap of death. That's where you can't just like observe what you did wrong and be like, oh, I see what I did wrong, go back and try again because you're already dead. There are some dangers with augmenting human intelligence if you can actually start to push that to the point where they could be a threat to all humanity if they wanted to. You know, obvious sci-fi scenarios here too, where by sci-fi, I don't mean like it can't happen because it's sci-fi. Things that science fiction authors have happened all the time. I mean that like science fictioners can and have figured out the obvious problems here. But it's possible to succeed. They are not complete aliens. You can take people who seem to start out pretty nice and not in the like super high profile nice, where maybe a sociopath is faking that kind of high profile niceness. But, you know, people who are just like very ordinary, nice, kind, decent people, and you're trying to augment their intelligence. Ideally, you do start out with smart nerds so that you're changing them less along the road to being John von Neumann. They're like starting out nice at a higher level of initial intelligence. But yeah, like these people are not aliens. Plausibly, some of them are not lying when they claim to be nice. There is a chance that this can succeed. And that is pretty different from the situation we are in. There's a chance that this can succeed in practice. And that's pretty different from the situation we are in with, you know, trying to align things that can't kill you yet and hoping that they don't kill you under the very different conditions of being able to kill you.
Totally.
Those people actually crack the alignment problem. They maybe don't even apply to access to the license monitor data centers because they don't need it. They can run an AI in a home computer. It'll still work. So there's even a question of like how much buy-in this needs from the, you know, international regulatory process, or maybe they're doing this under something like international supervision. But, you know, I wouldn't be in favor of that if, you know, like China got to send in their loyal Chinese guy and the United States got to send in their loyal United States guy. I think you just want some nice people and who started out fairly smart and then you make them a bunch smarter. They get the actual aligned superintelligence. They probably don't just send it straight out to unleash coherent extrapolated volition upon the world. They are probably building a super engineer and maybe using that to upload themselves into computers so that they can keep on working for this for another 1,000 years without the world burning down in the meantime. But, you know, they're running faster inside there. And so from our perspective, it's like only a day or 3 days, and then out comes the superintelligence that is actually supposed to be nice. And then we live happily ever afterwards. I think I would not immediately in the next 30 seconds of the happily ever after decide to grow tentacles. It has not been a lifelong ambition of mine to grow tentacles.
Oh, we differ in that regard.
I sure can't see myself like immediately going to, you know, back to, you know, age 20 body and, you know, preferably not even that exact body. There's all sorts of obvious improvements. I might not even want to go down a detailed checklist. I think this is AI could guess about me by reading what I've written on the internet, to say nothing of reading my mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, just go straight there. These things are trivial from my perspective. Abandoning my body entirely, well, why would I want to change that quickly? But in 1,000 years, would I still be a little organic life form running around? Would I still think of myself as having hands with 10 fingers? It seems improbable. You know, maybe 1,000 years, but you know, who's going to stick around with that for 100,000 years? Nobody.
This is a great point. I've just got time for two other short things, but we're really unpacking some stuff that I think is valuable to garner kind of your perspective on. Like you said, it's not part of the political package. Glad you said that. I mean, the intention of the show is not just sort of like, hey, what's the thing that you're banging into the world from a specific influence all day thing? It's also just like, how do you think about it? To what end are you coming at it from? Like, and again, that's the idea of throwing different people's layers on the problem just so we can splash at them and just see if any of it's solvable. So that's what I'm trying to do with it.
Into our cities full of conscious beings who care about each other, who are having fun. If sacrificing all of humanity were the only way and a reliable way to get, you know, beings, you know, like godlike beings out there, super intelligences who still care about each other and who are still aware of the world and are still having fun, I would ultimately make that trade-off. That is utterly not the trade-off we are faced with.
Yeah.
The space of things that care about each other and are having fun is a small target to hit in the space of non-biological intelligence. It is possible in principle. If we were a bit smarter, actually quite a lot smarter, we could do it, but if you just charge ahead, you don't get there.
Yeah.
But that's the end game for me. That's the stakes on the table to make the star cities.
Oddly, you know, identical, and many, you know, Sandberg, I mean, Bostrom, actually in terms of end game, despite sort of different way, you know, weaving paths, there are a number of people, not everybody. Some people are eternal hominid kingdom people, but there's many folks that have this notion. And like you said, if you could push the button, great, but not, we should not, you know, worthy successors will not just snap and just be it as soon as we click our fingers. The thing that gets hurled forth from steroids under strong AI is unlikely to be exactly what you articulated, as you just said.
Worthy successors will not kill us. This is a false trade-off.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm with you. But what you had said, if it was, if it was the choice between ending humanity to populate the galaxy with all that positive stuff, then, you know, maybe we would do it. But to your point, maybe a worthy successor wouldn't want to harm us in the first place. Do you think it's possible that you had just said we get our smart folks who are nice? I'll leave you to measure nice. I'm not much of a believer myself, but, you know, we get smart folks who are nice. We bump them up. And then, as you had said, possibly there's some upload scenarios where they can figure out elements of AI and finagling alignment. Is it conceivable to you that in that billion-year simulation of a bunch of these folks spinning together, you know, you had said
where the billion-year simulation is coming
from. You had said time will go faster for them. Maybe it's 1,000 years. You said they go in.
That's 1,000 years. A billion years is just kind of weird, man.
All right. Sure, let's use numbers, people. One comma, everybody. So update the number in your head. It's got one comma now. So they go up there for
1,000 years, not 1 million years, not 1 billion.
Okay, 100, and I'm talking simulated years anyway. But you're even talking 1,000 simulated years when this upload occurs.
Yeah, the people can upload 1,000 high speed. You know, like 100 or 1,000 high speed.
Exactly. Years. There we go. Yeah, exactly.
Simulated is a weird word with a lot of baggage. I don't.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, you're more of a stickler for semantics, but I'll let you step in and draw the words you want. But a 1,000 of those high speed years, as you had articulated. Is it possible that they come out of there conceiving of things other than or beyond. I don't mean they come out of their conceiving of malice as their highest goal, but they come out conceiving of lofty, more than worthy things to pursue that maybe we have no present words for and on some level can't imagine. Is it possible that in that 1,000 years sped up, that they think of things as high above us as we think of things beyond apes, which is to say even beyond kindness, maybe realms of consciousness beyond what we know to be consciousness, and things very much other than the pain-pleasure axis that could still be good, but in ways that we couldn't possibly conceive of as hominids? Is it possible that they discover a state space beyond the ideas you just articulated when they're in that uploaded state?
You know, first order question, yes. Second order question, it's way more complicated. And also, let's say that, you know, having thought of a thing that is fun to do besides kindness is not the same as having thought of a fun thing that supplants kindness. Like if they're coming out of there being like, ah, yes, we have discovered the glories of nuplophonium, and therefore we have abandoned all concept of being nice to other people because nuplophonium is so much better than being nice to people, and we're all going to kill you now. I bet that was more of a failure along the way than something that could ever have been the inevitable output of my own moral philosophy, which I would agree with if they could only explain it to me.
Yeah, if they could untangle the totality of it. So from your vantage point, almost the whole state, you take this nice, smart person, you bump them up there. Almost any of the vast, you know, Bostrom might talk about the state space of minds, you know, wherever they explore in there, they might have multiple versions of their consciousness working on different problems. They might be conceiving of things completely unbounded by biology. Whatever they pull out of that value space, if they come out, if it be good at all, to you, it will still very much blend with kindness and very much blend with fun, essentially, almost inevitably, I'm hearing you correctly.
If I were going in there, that would be an explicit goal going in. I don't think of these things as, like, it doesn't seem very likely that there is an objective, inevitable, any mind that starts in a frame remotely similar to mine cannot help but comprehend it argument for throwing away kindness. I think that the mind that throws away kindness has made a mistake relative to my own moral orientation starting out. I'd be going in there like determined to keep kindness, and I think that we might have different meta-ethical beliefs about the degree to which there is some outside truth that gets to tell me, no, you are wrong. You should not be kind. You should not care about other people. You should pursue fearfulness instead. I think that there's much more of an element of choice in which things you end up enjoying, and much less of this like outside independent factor that comes in and tells you to stop being nice.
And I'm not thinking of any sky daddy here, Yudkowsky. I don't know if that's what I'm coming across as.
I think that the opposite side here is not about God telling people not to be nice. It's about some inevitable chain of logic.
Either. I guess it's just like the total swimming state space of possible values that could be correlated to the total state space of possible end goods might land in places that could seem sparklingly fantastic to some grand posthuman intelligence, but maybe wouldn't consider us as much as you'd like. But what you're saying is that actual risk to you is not even as much of a risk, because you put the right kind person in there and they're not going to drop that ball. They're going to come out no matter how much they've seen, and kindness will still be a part of what they are.
I'm saying you are sending people in with the determination to keep the flame of kindness alive. This is not like something that just happens to you once you get up to, if I dare say it, the Eliezer Yudkowsky level of intelligence. You are looking over this landscape of possibilities. You understand how logic has the power to move people, and what, you know, like what logic is as contrasted to probabilistic reasoning. And here's, you know, like these emotions influencing you. And, you know, here's all the stuff about meta ethics that I wrote about 15 years ago. And you're not going in there being like, I shall be buffeted about by the winds of post-humanity and eventually emerge a butterfly, and who knows what I shall like then. You're like, all right, you primitive screwheads, listen up. We're going into this to augment our intelligence, and that's going to break everything, and we're going to fix it, and we're going to come out of this still nice. This is our glorious mission into the unknown, and we're going to do it with care.
You know, I there's so much to unpack here in terms of like the viability there, but the idea that for you, again, when they go in, That's the explicit mission. It's sort of solve these issues and also carry these values for you. Like, this really gives me a good grounding of, you know, your articulation of kindness, I think, really settles very deep in terms of what you care about. Like, we don't have the time to fully unpack it, but hopefully there's some essays about it. But I think this is, and hopefully for the folks who are tuned in, a good understanding of how you would want to manage the risk and to what end. Because I understand that right now you've got to beat the war drum of it's going to kill us, it's going to kill us. I fully understand. I fully get it.
Well, yes, it's going to kill us, you see.
But I think I think the 1920s voice, I think that there is some credence possibly that if there's a positive to what end, there might be some part of that that conjures people to maybe move in the direction of that positive future in addition to just running away from risk. I think there is some potential motive force, and I could be wrong. It might just be a force of division, but I think painting what this could be like if it went well, I think those ideas could be kick butt. And I really enjoyed learning from yours. I know that's all we have for time, Mr. Yudkowsky, but it's been a real pleasure being able to unpack your ideas.
Alrighty, Eddie. Just don't be too reluctant to shake hands with people who have some disagreements about these issues, but would rather we did not all immediately go extinct.
So that's all for this episode of The Trajectory, and that is the end of our AGI governance series. I'm grateful to you for being able to tune in, and a big thank you to Eliezer for being our sixth and final episode. I hope that for all of you who've heard many of Eliezer's thoughts and followed him on Twitter, you've never seen him go down those rabbit holes. I thought that was a tremendous amount of fun. And in my personal opinion, throughout this entire series, I think it's important to be able to paint what kind of destination we're getting to. I understand there might be some disagreements about that, but I think without a vision, it's going to be tough to sort of marshal the required efforts to make international coordination come together. And it was a heck of a lot of fun to unpack that with Eliezer in this episode. So we'll be getting into our next series next. I hope you enjoyed this one.